Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's not often thought of as a battlefront in this war, but what is going on inside organized religious communities, most especially the Catholic Church, is indeed part of the struggle for Western civilization, it seems to me, and I believe that is very much of the view of our first guest. His name is José Ureta. He is a Chilean by birth, associated with a very influential pro-life and pro-family Chilean organization known as Fundación Roma. He also works with our friends at Tradition, Family, and Property, and has come to our attention thanks to their intervention in connection with his new book, which apparently is rocking Rome and I think the Catholic Church perhaps more broadly. It's entitled Pope Francis' Paradigm Shift, Continuity or Rupture in the Mission of the Church. It's an assessment of his five-year pontificate, and it's a great pleasure to have José Ureta with us to talk a little bit about it and some of its implications. So, José, welcome. It's so good to have you with us. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk.
Thank you, Frank. It's a real honor for me to speak to the Center for Security Policy and your radio.
Well, thank you. So Pope Francis, of course, was the first pope from the Western Hemisphere and has been marked in many ways as a break with the past. Talk about the paradigm shift as you see it and its meaning, both for the Church, its theology, and perhaps its politics as well.
Yes, actually, my book focuses a lot on geopolitics because it focuses on the issues that affect more lay people in temporal society, not theological problems with ecclesiology. So the issues where I see a very strong paradigm shift are, for instance, the abandonment of the fight for non-negotiable values that Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II had overtaken so much, this defense of the sacredness of life and family and marriage as being a man and a woman and the rights of parents to educate their children.
In other words, traditional values, I think it's fair to say.
He had abandoned this in favor of favoring the neo-Marxist agenda of this so-called popular movement, you know, in Latin America and elsewhere.
This so-called liberation theology, is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, he supports the Argentinian version of liberation theology. It's called the theology of the people, and it comes very close to his Peronist leanings, and which has a geopolitical impact.
Yes, indeed it does. And as you've seen that playing out inside the Church, there has clearly been a growing, I think it's fair to say, resistance to this sort of Marxist agenda of the Pope, the rupture of the mission of the Church, I think is the way you put it in your book subtitle. So what is that shaping up to be as you see it, José Ureta? Is that a real threat to this papacy?
Yeah, it is. It is because he, at the beginning, appeared as very popular because of being simple, humble, and in the sight of the poor, etc. But little by little, this political agenda had appeared, and then people are reacting against it. You see, for instance, in Latin America, he favored very much the agreement between the Colombian government and the guerrilla, communist guerrilla of the FARC, And in spite of all the propaganda made because of the support of the Pope for this treaty, the population rejected it clearly. Also in Brazil, he clearly supports this so-called popular movement, very much linked with the Workers' Party of former President Lula da Silva. But in the last presidential election, the Workers' Party was defeated, and it was Jair Bolsonaro, representing the traditional values, who won. And in Argentina, he doesn't even dare to land in his own country because he knows that population disagrees with his support for the king, Cristina Kirchner.
The Peronists, yeah. So to put a fine point on this, one of the things that has struck me as a feature of this papacy, of course, has been sort of the resurgent problem. This may be something of an exaggeration, but that's how it is perceived by many of us, I think, of this sort of predatory homosexuality within the church, on the one hand, and also, Jose, this tendency from the Pope, most especially, but also a cardinal by the name of McCarrick, for the so-called interfaith dialogue with Sharia supremacists that seem very much at odds with, you know, the vital interests of the church, let alone its future survival. Could you talk about, in the person of McCarrick himself, this nexus?
Yeah, that it's a terrible thing, because it is clear that the church is infiltrated by a network of homosexuals and who support each other. That's the only thing that explains how it was possible for McCarrick to become Archbishop of Washington and a cardinal.
And to be rehabilitated by this Pope, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
And in spite of that, the Pope insists that it's not the homosexuality of those priests abusing young kids. No, 84% of their victims are adolescent males. So the predators were homosexuals. No? But in spite of that, the Pope says that the reason for the cause of this crisis is clericalism. I mean, the abuse of power by the clergy.
And perhaps there's something to that, but it certainly does seem as though there you have to ignore one of the impetuses behind that abuse to get to the clericalism line. And how about this interfaith dialogue business? Do you see this as part of the paradigm shift as well?
That's one of the chapters of my book precisely deals with that, because in Pope Francis' speeches, migration and welcoming are recurrent topics. You know? So he wants a kind of opening of the West to migrants, and it sees it as a non-negotiable principle. And because of that, dialogue with Islam at whatever cost is part of the deal, minimizing Islam's terrorist matrix.
Right. Well, and its larger agenda of, as I say, Sharia supremacism sort of dominating the West and transforming it. This is clearly a topic to which we must return. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Daniel Horowitz about criminal justice reform, immigration, and invasion right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit inside the economic war room with the man who is its master. He is, of course, Kevin Freeman, and that program is now featured on the Blaze Media Network, a brand new product of collaboration between Mark Levin's CRTV and Glenn Beck's Blaze Network, and it is so exciting to have Kevin, our senior fellow, who specializes here at the Center for Security Policy on Economic Warfare Matters, and the author of two superb and best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, now achieving the celebrity that he is due with this much amplified platform. Kevin, congratulations on this important development, and I can't tell you how excited I am about the possibility that, well, it sounds like hundreds of millions of Americans may be exposed as a result to your important programming on economic warfare matters. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, thank you, Frank. Our purpose in the economic war room is to recombine national security and economic security. And too many people, too many Americans have felt that the government was not interested in their situation and that all these big decisions are being made without them. And so they're worried about their economic security. And at the same time, the national security community ought to be looking at the fact that we're being undermined, that we have enemies and adversaries that are undermining our economic security. And the economic weapons have been pointed at us. We've only thought about sanctions, and we've thought about how we can apply, cutting off terrorist funds and so forth. That to us as Americans has been all that we've discussed in economic warfare. We're bringing Americans into the reality and understanding that they're targets too and what they can do about it. So it's an honor to be able to bring these stories forth.
Yeah, no, it's important work, and I'm glad you feel that way. If ever there were an example of what the nexus is between economic activities and national security ones, it would certainly be one of the takeaways, I think, of the arrest by Canadian authorities of this Huawei chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou. What can you tell us about her, about what her company has been up to, Kevin, and how what it's up to does, in fact, impinge very dramatically, perhaps, on the, well, public safety and national security of Americans?
Well, let's step back and realize Huawei is probably the second largest manufacturer of mobile phone devices in the world. They make a lot of the technological infrastructure that underpins the cellular networks, and they have tentacles into most major technology companies around the world. But it was founded by a former officer of the People's Liberation Army. It is a company that has been allowed to prosper in communist China, which means they have the government support. And the daughter of the founder is the CFO that was arrested in Canada. And the basis for the charges, we don't know what all it is, but it seems as if it might include sanctions violations and doing business against the international sanctions imposed on the Iranian government. And, you know, this is a potentially bad actor player. And it is so serious that several governments have entirely banned the use of Huawei technology. And it's under consideration in Japan, Australia, the United States. There are a number of countries who said, wow, if the Chinese government's connected company can put the infrastructure in place, they'll have a backdoor to spy on people. They'll have a backdoor to control the future of mobile computing and the internet. And so it really is the nexus of international security with our economic security.
Yeah. Do you anticipate she will, in fact, be extradited to the United States, Kevin?
Well, we'll push for it. I have no idea if, you know, the fact that we got Canada to arrest her on these charges is quite a coup for the Trump administration. It shows that they recognize the seriousness of the charges. Whether or not we get her here or if she gets swapped with something, the important thing is it's exposed the risks that may be inherent in doing business with this company, and every nation should step back and say, wait, this is a communist nation, China, and this is a approved company that is offering the most sensitive technologies around the world. Do you want to be on their standard? Do you want to be on a standard of another company that maybe doesn't have the deep PLA ties that this one does?
Yeah. And those ties are likely, as you've said, to mean surveillance and perhaps a compromise of private information, perhaps manipulation, definitely the empowering of state authorities, not just the Chinese, but some of their friends and allies who will almost certainly manipulate this kind of information flow if indeed we find ourselves heeding the siren's call of Huawei. So I hope that this woman will arrive on our shores and be very thoroughly interrogated for information about what is going on inside that company and exactly what the implications are for us. This brings me to a related question, though, Kevin Freeman. Another entity, this one an American one, or at least nominally so, Google has also been, it seems, putting its technologies and personnel in the service of Chinese efforts to control their population, to manipulate them, to otherwise obtain information that should be considered private. Talk to us about what the folks at Google are up to. This is the subject of a hearing today, as it happens, with the CEO, Sundar Pichai. Tell us about what you make of what's going on with Google and the Chinese at the moment.
Well, it wasn't too many years ago that Google took what they claimed to be a very principled stance. It was certainly a public stance that they were pulling out of China, that they weren't going to allow for Chinese censorship. Now, skeptics pointed and said, well, Google had very little market share, had made very little progress in China, and so, you know, that didn't cost them anything to exit. But the re-entrance into the Chinese market with a project codenamed Dragonfly has clearly been with the support of the Chinese government, and it very likely is allowing the Chinese government to better control its citizens, which is what collectivist communist states do. They seek control of their citizens, and that's disconcerting enough. But when you have Google cooperating with the Chinese government and you have Google executives claiming they refuse to cooperate with our defense establishment here, you got to wonder which team they're playing for.
Yeah, whose side are they on, indeed? I hope that last bit will also be a feature of these hearings. This is, of course, the last round there will be under Republican management, and I don't know whether the Democrats will be similarly disposed to press on this, though there are certainly some Democrats who are as concerned as the rest of us are about what the Chinese are up to, and for that matter, I guess, to some extent at least, what Google is up to. So let's hope that not only will this hearing be enlightening in terms of the attitudes and conduct of Google, but also a precursor to even more rigorous investigation of all of this in the new Congress. Kevin, lastly and quickly, what do you make of what's going on with Brexit in the United Kingdom? There are huge economic implications of this, we're told. The May government seems imperiled by it, but perhaps much more is at stake as well. Talk us through that, if you would.
Well, Britain's gone its own way a little bit in Europe all along. They never joined the common currency, the euro, and they kept the British pound, and that's to the benefit of the British people, I believe. Now it appears that the appetite for Brexit has waned inside the country as the negotiations have dragged out so long. But my concern, and what the British people ought to be asking, is does the European Union have a future under any circumstances? I mean, you see the riots in France. You see the pushback in Germany over immigration policies. People don't want Brussels determining their lives, and that's the impetus behind Brexit, and that is the impetus, I think, for a lot of the pushback on policies that are Brussels-friendly policies on climate and immigration and taxation and so many other areas. This the European Union may not be able to hold together on its own. I think the Brexit question is very timely, but I hope that the British people recognize that's what they voted for and they need to move forward with it.
Yeah, amen. So, Kevin, do you credit the argument that if there isn't this deal, or perhaps some slightly tweaked version of it, if there is going to be a further negotiation between Britain and the European Union, that this deal will wind up the absence of such a deal, rather, would wind up creating a hard Brexit, as they call it, that would be very disruptive to the economies of the Brits, most especially, but also perhaps of Europe as well.
Well, what I'm most concerned about, the hard Brexit is going to be the failure of the European Union, and I don't think people are talking about that in those terms. But when you just look at what's happening in the individual states, this is the sooner the British can get out, the better for them. So I don't know how it's all going to play out, but I don't think staying in the sinking ship is necessarily in their best interest, and I think that that's a legitimate question.
Yeah. Yeah, it is indeed, and it's one that ought to be very much front and center for the Brits as they work their way through this in the days ahead. Kevin Freeman, thank you for working through so much of this with us and for the great work you are doing now at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we will speak with Daniel Horowitz right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's my great pleasure to say, joined by a man that I've come to admire tremendously for his intellect, for his clarity, for his courage in describing the public policy choices facing our country in so many different arenas, but most immediately and most especially, perhaps, with respect to what has come to be called the First Step Act. This is a bill that is now awaiting action. We're told Mitch McConnell will bring up this legislation perhaps as early as late this week as part of a larger criminal justice reform agenda. Daniel Horowitz has been very critical of this agenda and this act in particular. He is a senior editor at Conservative Review, now part of the Blaze Media operation, I believe, and one of the most prolific and thoughtful contributors, as I say, to the public policy issues and debates about them of our time. His newest book is Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. We're always glad to have him with us, but most especially today. Daniel, I know this is a very busy moment for you. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about the First Step Act.
Really appreciate the opportunity, and yes, it truly is a troubling day.
It is indeed. So one of the reasons that it's troubling, it seems to me, is the process that is being applied here to a very consequential piece of legislation. Just remind us what's going on with this legislation and how, as I think of it, the adage, you want it bad, you get it bad, seems to be applying.
I've never quite seen an issue like this in my entire career, a public policy issue like this, at a time when we have a crisis with transnational cartels, transnational gangs, mainly foreign nationals responsible for the worst drug crisis in this country that everyone recognizes. I just spoke with officials in DEA and ICE in New England, and they say that these drug traffickers, which are largely fueled by illegal immigration, these illegal gangs and cartels are single-handedly responsible for the thousands of fatalities in New Hampshire, Maine, and Massachusetts. These very people are the ones that now these geniuses in Washington want to A, early release from prison, and B, at the front end, reduce sentencing for the drug traffickers. And again, these are the people that the federal prosecutors go after. They're the gangbangers. These are the top-level people. They don't go after the small little pushers and give them 30 years. It's a myth. It certainly not hasn't been done in 15 years. And priorities. I mean, we have an immigration crisis. We have a budget crisis. But this is the one issue for which they're willing to stay through Christmas for.
Yeah. You know, as it happens, this morning I heard on National Public Radio a piece that was relatively sympathetic treatment of police officers, interestingly enough, primarily because it was documenting how fewer and fewer people are willing to become police officers, and the workload that is currently weighing on those who are serving is that much more intense, of course. And it sort of ended with this slightly wistful line that we sure hope that we'll be able to continue to keep crime rates relatively low despite the reduced number of law enforcement officers tasked with that job. This would seem to be a bad time to be letting out large numbers of people, even if one claims, as we endlessly hear, Daniel Horowitz, that they're nonviolent criminals, to add to the burden of those law enforcement personnel, especially given the high recidivism rates that seem to be associated with a lot of these crimes. Talk us through that, if you would.
Well, no, there's no, they're going to cure recidivism because they have to engage in, quote, productive activities and programs that show some proof that they're reduced recidivism. I mean, this bill is Orwellian. To speak to your point, here's the issue. They want to have it both ways. They want the talking point of saving money, but then they want to release, I mean, literally 4,000 immediately and then tens of thousands more over time. And again, the people in the federal system, you have to understand the federal system is distinct from the state system. It's a backstop to the state system. So federal prosecutors will only go after these guys that are most often the big gangbangers that are responsible for murder, robbery, arson, all sorts of things. And the easiest tool they have to lock them up are the drug charges, but often they're even worse than that. And that's bad enough, given the drug crisis. So you release these people out over a short period of time, but they don't want to fund more resources because then, you know, they can't have the talking point that they're saving money. And this is what the prison wardens pointed out. The prison wardens union opposes this. Another example of this is that they allow, even aside from the jailbreak component within prison, they mandate hundreds of minutes more of phone time and internet time and rec time. This stuff is very dangerous. When you're talking about the El Chapo type of people in prison, you really need more wardens to monitor that, but they don't appropriate the resources, and they do so purposely. The National Sheriff's Association has pointed out the unfunded liability this will be on local law enforcement, how they're going to deal with the home confinement of thousands more. I mean, this thing hasn't been thought out. I could go on and on about the provisions, but this bill, as Chuck Grassley said before he flipped on the issue, it's promoted as a matter of ideology, and it's Orwellian, where facts simply don't matter.
Well, the thing that's peculiar about it is that the right seems to be enthralled with this ideology of the left as well. Van Jones is one of the principal drivers behind this, and as a communist hardline guy on the left, he would seem an unlikely ally for some of the people that we work with all the time on the right, Daniel Horowitz. Explain what the ideology is that's operating here.
Well, CNN, MSNBC, The New York Times, they exist to tell us, I guess, that we are fecal matter. Fox News exists to tell us that the fecal matter on us is really water, and it's good. This is the problem. This is our leadership. We have Fox News that for the first time in 30 years took a position on a bill, which should tell your listeners everything they need to know about the nature, the insidious nature of how this is being pushed. The masters of the universe, all the globalists, all the people that decide what's moral and right have decided this is their issue du jour. I mean, and think about it. Whatever you believe on the issue, where the heck did this come from? I mean, we have emergencies on sanctuary cities at the border. We have literally 3,000 people a day being apprehended at the border. That's a pace of a million a year. And there's no impetus to act on it. Yet when it comes to this, there's some hellfire emergency because, again, the so-called conservative leadership and all their outlets are rotten to the core. I could go on and on about Fox News, but this is the problem.
Yeah. So there is a head of steam up behind this, that's for sure. The provenance of it seems to have something to do with people like George Soros and the Koch brothers, among others. I wonder whether, Daniel, you would find it fair to say that this has not gotten the kind of scrutiny, particularly the bill that is seemingly being changed by the moment, that it would warrant, given the kind of far-reaching implications that it should have. And if so, that we're likely to see in this lame duck, as we have frequently in the past, major sweeping legislation with profound implications for public safety, public health, public, you know, the national security perhaps as well, being blown through without the kind of care that is simply necessary.
This is such a complex issue that it's inextricably tied into transnational drug trafficking, illegal immigration. And then, yes, you mentioned national security. As Chuck Grassley, again, before the Kochs bought him off, gave a whole speech in 2014 that back then, and certainly more so 4 years later, increasingly terrorism, particularly Hezbollah, is turning to drug trafficking, cocaine in particular, as the honeypot to fund their terrorism. So when you get rid of mandatory minimums and you have all these leniencies, you reduce a lot of the leverage you have as an investigative tool to bust up these networks. I mean, there's so many consequences we haven't held hearings on. They put this behind closed doors. They don't want to have a protracted debate over it. This is driven by insanity. It's all the masters of the universe, the corporate cultural institutions are all behind it. And wait a minute. I mean, people forget that along with the destruction of the Soviet Union, the 70% decline in violent crime in this country is the biggest legacy of Ronald Reagan. It was because of these drug trafficking laws and the gun trafficking laws and the Armed Career Criminal Act that they want to gut now that we took all these people off the streets, because the truth be told, we need criminal justice reform, all right? We need to make it easier to land a conviction on these violent people. Too many of them get off. Hundreds of thousands every year, murder, robbery, rape, aggravated assault. Cases go uncleared because it's so hard to land a conviction. What the drug laws did is it gave us the ability to take them off the streets, and that is why we actualized this decline in crime in the 90s and early 2000s, and we're slowly reversing that in major urban areas because the pendulum has already swung back the other way, even without any leniencies. Maybe there was a time, you know, 2000 to 2005 era at a state level, maybe we were locking up too many people for simple possession. That none of that is happening now, and none of that at a federal level.
Yeah, and that's really such a key point, Daniel Horowitz. There does seem to be room for improvement on recidivism training, perhaps, and sentencing and the like at the state level in a number of states around the country. But what you've pointed out so eloquently is at the federal level, you're talking about serious, hardened criminals who are in the federal system. And to the extent that we're going to actually turn these guys loose on the basis that reforms are warranted elsewhere at the other levels of the criminal justice system is just kind of a mind-boggling error and of great import, obviously. Daniel Horowitz, thank you for your critical analysis at Conservative Review, Daniel, and for all that you do to try to make sure that these kinds of issues are getting the scrutiny that they require. God bless you. Keep up the good work and come back to us again, if you would, very soon.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Ilan Berman, Esquire, a man who has done incalculably important work, notably as the senior vice president at the American Foreign Policy Council, but through myriad outlets, including Forbes and his many books, including Tehran Rising, Iran's Challenge to the United States, and in addition, Iran's Deadly Ambition, the Islamic Republic's Quest for Global Power. He is the editor of a brand new book, as it turns out, entitled Digital Dictators. And he's generously agreed to come back for a full hour to talk about what is going on with sort of the rising tide of authoritarianism, both overseas and even among social media platforms and the like in this country, that we should be very concerned about. He is a member of the Associated Faculty of the Missouri State University's Department of Defense and Strategic Studies, one of my favorite academic institutions and a great resource to this program. We're always delighted to have him. Ilan Berman, welcome back.
Oh, it's so good to be back.
Well, let's talk first about the Sea of Azov. This is a body of water that I have the feeling most of us had never heard of before, but it has suddenly been thrust into the forefront of our national security consciousness by, it seems, a Russian play to essentially strangle Ukraine's activities in that sea. Talk to us about what's going on there, Ilan, and what the implications are, not just for Ukraine, but for freedom of navigation and the like.
Sure. Well, so the naval skirmish, the naval military skirmish that took place about 2 weeks ago in the Sea of Azov happened when this body of water, which links up with the Black Sea through a strait called the Kerch Strait, over which the Russians have been building a big and a very controversial bridge, which we can talk about later. The Russians essentially shut off the Sea of Azov, which is considered international waters, shut it off from free transit for Ukrainian naval vessels, and then they proceeded to fire upon the vessels and proceeded to board them and seize the Ukrainian sailors. And it precipitated a crisis, but a crisis that I think hasn't really been fully appreciated, both in terms of its causal factors, but also in terms of what it actually signifies for the balance of power between Russia and Ukraine, and also for what the United States and NATO need to do next.
Well, let's talk about all of those, because I think that's exactly the point. What were the causal factors?
So my sense is, for people who watch Russia and watch what Russia has been doing and saying, this was really not a surprise. For people who aren't aware of the correlation of forces, it may be. But in reality, the writing for this sort of escalation of hostilities has been on the wall for quite a while.
Well, that bridge is kind of a telegraphed punch, don't you think? A low bridge.
Absolutely. And it's also a very physical manifestation of Russia's strengthening hold over the Crimean Peninsula, which they seized after a stage-managed political referendum back in 2014. So Russia is doing what happened a couple of weeks ago is of a piece with Russia's efforts to incrementally strengthen its control over territory that was once Ukraine's and make that situation irreversible. So the latest shot across the bow of the Ukrainians both was to demonstrate to Ukraine, but also to demonstrate to everybody else that Russia has such strong military presence in the Sea of Azov, in the Black Sea, that commercial transit, even in international waters there, is subject to the Kremlin's fiat, that the Kremlin can essentially cancel that writ at any time. And that has all sorts of implications because much of Ukraine's financial well-being and economic wealth comes from maritime shipping. So what the Russians are trying to do in a not-so-subtle fashion is make it difficult for European countries and European companies, and risky for them, to do business with Ukraine and to erode Ukraine's sovereignty in that way.
And so the broader implications, the geostrategic implications you brought home in a recent piece, Ilan Berman, are heightened by the fact that in the period since the seizure of Crimea and of parts of eastern Ukraine by the Russians or their proxies, the Ukrainian military has been considerably upgunned, as it were, including by shipments of arms and military technologies from the West. So is this teeing up, in your judgment, to an imminent and much more intense conflict between the Russians and Ukrainians?
Well, this is both a good news story and I think a bad news story. One of the unintended consequences of Russia's aggression beginning in 2014 has been this massive surge of Ukrainian nationalism. Ukraine as a country is much more unified now against Russia than it ever has been before in terms of cohesive national identity. And it's also precipitated a massive recapitalization of the Ukrainian military, which has been bolstered by assistance from the United States and assistance from European countries. But there's a chink in that armor, and the chink in that armor is precisely where the Russians hit a couple of weeks ago, because the Ukrainian Navy has fared very, very poorly in the overall calculus. When Russia took over Crimea in the first half of 2014, something like 70% of Ukrainian naval hardware and 70% of Ukrainian personnel essentially left the service. The materiel was seized, and the personnel either defected to the Russian side or essentially went AWOL, sort of left their posts. And the Ukrainian Navy has languished in this limbo ever since, so much so that it's really become provocatively weak. And this is precisely the weak point where the Russians hit.
So, no accident, comrade, as the Soviets used to say. You have laid out in one of your recent publications, Ilan, a sort of prescription for what a resolute Western response to this kind of aggression by the Russian government would be. Give us, in a short form, if you would, a sense of that.
Sure. Well, I think the first step and the most logical step is to try to reverse exactly what Russia is doing. Russia, by carrying out its military aggression in the Sea of Azov, is trying to telegraph to European countries not to do business with Ukraine. And if they take that bait, if those countries and those companies take that bait, Ukraine's financial situation becomes much, much worse. So the first priority for European countries, probably most likely operating through NATO, has to be to maintain freedom of navigation in the Black Sea and in the Sea of Azov, to allow commercial ships to transit without them being worried that the Russians might carry out a sort of a naval assault on them. And that has the very salutary secondary effect of inserting more Western forces into a body of water where, absent a Western presence, the Russians are likely to run the table. But that's just the first step. I think the second step, and this is really, I think, gets to the heart of what the Russians are worried about, is what you've seen, particularly in Congress over the last 6 years or so, has been this very remarkable ramping up of targeted economic pressure against Russia, built around the death in 2009 of a Russian lawyer named Sergei Magnitsky, who was uncovered graft on a massive scale in Russia. For his trouble, he was incarcerated by Russian authorities, who accused him of carrying out the corruption. He was mistreated in prison. He wasn't given proper medical attention, and he ended up dying of medical complications in prison. And his story became this celebrated cause for human rights campaigners, culminating in the passage in 2012 of something called the Sergei Magnitsky Act here in Congress, which allowed the U.S. Congress to reach out and touch officials that were directly involved in Magnitsky's untimely death through travel bans, asset freezes, essentially targeted sanctions. And then in 2016, we went a step further and we expanded Magnitsky onto a global scale. We essentially wrote legislation that said that this is a really good paradigm. We want to keep applying it to the Russians, but we want to have the ability to apply it to others as well, to Iran, to China, to other bad actors. This has sort of kicked off a very vibrant international conversation about how to use these types of targeted sanctions to really limit Russia's freedom of maneuver abroad. So now, today, as of right now, there are 8 European countries that have passed some version of what's called Global Magnitsky. Canada has passed a version of Global Magnitsky. The European Parliament has passed a version of Global Magnitsky. And more than that, there's at least as many other countries that are considering these forms.
Ilan Berman, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We thank you so much for your time today. I hope we'll have a chance to talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.